sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
October shows a big turnaround for global equities. A surprise report out of China. The Fed did another flip-flop, revealing the big loser from this week's Republican debate and a technical look at market rotation. All this and much more on episode number 436 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to November. This is Andrew Horowitz, your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we're going solo today, no guests, so we can get into some of the detail of what's going on around the world here in the U.S., as well as some of the important news that we need to go over about what's happening with equities, bond markets, the China situation. There's all sorts of news to discuss. So I thought we would spend some time together, just us, talking about what is going on and what do we have to look forward to. So it is the beginning of November. October clearly saw an amazing turnaround in terms of investor sentiment around the world, where it almost stopped on a dime at the end of September. And lo and behold, wow, we love stocks again. One of the big things and the driver that we've seen over the last several years has been that underneath all of this is the continuing support and reassurance by the various central banks around the world. They are going to do whatever it takes. I mean, whatever it takes to, no matter how bad it is, by the way, to actually get things rolling in the right direction. I think one of the most fascinating things that we saw over the last couple of weeks was the recommitment and the reestablishment of the potential for higher amounts of quantitative easing from the ECB. Mario Draghi came out and laid down some of his thoughts and said that, you know, if we can't get inflation rising, and in fact, if we can't get the economy moving faster, we may have to actually add to the quantitative easing program, for which just 6 or 8 months ago, whatever it was, they started. And it was supposed to be the amount that was going to do just wondrous things. And markets in the European region flew up. Bonds were being bought like crazy. We saw that there was several times over the last months that bonds in that region, like two-year bonds, went actually negative. This happened again a couple of weeks back when this announcement was made. And we saw that the Italian two-year went negative. In other words, if you were to invest money in a two-year Italian bond, $100,000 you put in when that was a negative yield to maturity. So let's say it was just a slight negative. You put in $100,000, you're guaranteed to get back, let's just say, $99,500. Because what happens is the price is so high compared to how much interest you'll earn on it when you add that back and it matures at the par value of $100,000, let's say. Well, you're just going to get back your $100,000, but you actually paid in excess of $100,000 for it, in excess of the $100,000 plus the interest that you're going to actually receive. And this is what distortion is occurring due to much of the quantitative easing programs and also the changing the liquidity around the world in terms of how much is really available to investors as compared to what is really available to the central banks. In fact, I read a story over the weekend that talked about that the Japanese government now owns like 50% of the value of the ETFs in the Japanese market, because they're actively buying stocks through ETFs, real estate investment trusts, in the Japanese market. That's probably why, if you think about it, there is such a, I guess it would be a very positive view on Japanese equities by many analysts. Maybe it has nothing to do with the fact that they're going to be making money, there'll be consolidations, there'll be expenses, you know, coming off and earnings coming up. Maybe it's all about the fact that they know and they're thinking that Well, it doesn't really matter because the Japanese government is committed to buying all sorts of things, inclusive of their own bonds, their treasuries, and market-related instruments. And therefore, how bad can it get? Now, we did see this same situation in a different manner and unfold in a different way in China recently, of course, where the market was up probably 100+% in the Shanghai and Shenzhen index in about a year or so. And then it came just, you know, crashing down. In fact, one of the big things that's happening in China right now is that many investors have really seen a tremendous amount of losses on their money because they were encouraged to actually go in and buy stocks on leverage or margin. They would take their life savings and they'd invest it. Plus, they would go out and borrow more money that was offered to them by the brokerage house. And what they would do is they would buy, let's say, a multiple. Maybe they would say, well, we're going to put in $50,000, $100,000, and actually we're going to be controlling somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $200,000 of equities. And as stocks came down, they were wiped out. So there is ways to do it, and there are, you know, good ways and bad ways to do this whole plan that they're trying to do. But I don't see that the benefit of government actually investing into private enterprise is the way to play. Let's talk about some of the things before we get into much more detail about what's happening around the world. Let's talk a little bit about some of the economics and some of the things that we saw last week. We did see that the various indices were up ever so slightly by the end of the week. Towards the end of the week, as a matter of fact, on Friday, starting about 3 o'clock, we saw that markets rolled over a bit, probably just cleaning up some positions into the end of the month. NASDAQ added about 0.5% through the week. S&P rose marginally, and the Dow just eked out a gain of about 0.1%. We had a lot of things that happened throughout the week. We saw the GDP number in the United States came out at 1.5%, which was, I would say, that's substantially lower than really what had been hoped for, where we saw that in the last quarter, there was a 3.9%. Now, a lot of that came from inventory build. And if you haven't been with us for very long listening to the show, we've talked about this whole interesting inventory build and drop and how it actually affects GDP. And I'll talk about that for a second, but I want to let you know that one of the better ways to look at inventories versus a monthly or a quarterly is to take a look at it over a period of time, because you'll see a rise in inventories for a variety of reasons. You may see a rise in inventories due to the fact that maybe sales aren't good. And what's happening is the manufacturers are still manufacturing and the retail stores are behind the curve. They're stocking up because they saw some sales that were good, or they made a mistake and they thought that sales would be good. And then what happens is that it sits on the shelves and then it backs up because the retailers are not buying anymore. Manufacturers may be still producing, so it stocks up on their shelves as well. And what happens is slowly but surely, the manufacturers stop manufacturing. The inventory goes down ever so slightly once it does sell. If you see an elongated period of inventory builds, well, one of two things are happening. Either manufacturers aren't getting the hint that things are slowing down, or what's happening is that there is a tremendous amount of a drop in retail sales or in sales in general that is not hasn't been anticipated, and they just can't get anything off of their shelves, even with sales, et cetera. Now, when you see an inventory build, it would seem probably logical that there's a slowdown, right? You know, you see that the inventories build, and what do you think? Well, that means sales aren't good, et cetera. It could be that manufacturing has kicked into higher gear for some reason, maybe an outlook that looks better in a month or so, and they really started to increase their manufacturing, build up their inventories because they know there's going to be big orders in. Maybe the stores told them, hey, we're going to have some great orders coming in, big orders in a couple of months, get ready. Well, whatever the case may be, when inventories build, it is a positive effect on GDP. So you see this positive effect on GDP when you have an inventory build. That may be a little bit counterintuitive, but it is output. It is manufacturing output. Now, you can count one of two things, right? Is the inventory build really a negative in theory? If you think about this, an inventory build should really, in a way, be a negative on GDP, because if you have an inventory build, it means probably you don't have sales or sales are slowing. And just let's just count the manufacturing numbers. But no matter what we may think it is, the fact is that when you have an inventory build, and inventories do grow, it is a plus on the side of GDP. When inventories drop, it's negative to GDP. Once again, when inventories drop, we may think that there's a lot of sales going on and buyers are really out there going out and buying everything off the shelves and manufacturers can't keep up with it and retail stores are obviously selling a lot more. But for whatever the reason, inventories dropping is a negative to GDP. And again, there's a lot of different ways to look at this. But the fact is, that's how it is actually calculated. So we saw that there was a nice gain in quarterly personal spending, about a 3.2% quarterly gain, which was good. But business spending and business investment dropped substantially. So we saw that inventories dropped the largest amount since 2012. We saw a very big drop in business spending and investment. But consumers continue to spend, which is really kind of interesting because we saw two numbers also out recently about consumer confidence. We saw the Commerce Department come out and they talked about how personal spending was up about 0.1% for September. Then we saw the Conference Board come out with their consumer confidence index. It fell about 5 points in October to about 97.5. But the University of Michigan's household sentiment survey rose 2.5 points. And hit 90. The Conference Board and the University of Michigan have not been working together very well recently. And you have to wonder what's the difference in terms of the selection set that they're using for their polling and for their confidence data. But nonetheless, it's still not in a bad situation. I would have thought actually that the October numbers for the sentiment index would have dropped much further than they did. It was odd, I thought, that September's numbers were up. But you would think that with the market route, with the situation that we saw, looking back into September and the beginning of October, the after effects of all that would have really clamped down on confidence. But it didn't very much. We did also see that there were less new homes sold in September. So a 15.2% drop, according to the Census Bureau. And the yearly sales pace hit a 10-month low. So the NAR report, the National Association of Realtors report, declined about 2.5% in its pending home sales index for September. The good news was, I guess, that we're still seeing that home prices are staying up. We're seeing that the Case-Shiller numbers that came out last week ticked higher, up to about 4.7% for the 12 months on the average price of a house for existing home prices. We're up 4.7% on an annual basis. So that's good. That's keeping the general pace that we've seen over the last few years, anywhere from 4 to 6% has been the average annual increase in existing home sales prices. Obviously, it is. It depends on what particular city you're in. You know that California, Texas, Florida, New York have seen some unbelievable pricing increases. Some of the areas that we've seen some drops obviously have been the fracking areas and the very, very oil-dependent areas around the country, as well as some of the farmland areas has not seen as much of a recent uptick or the sustained uptick that we've seen. Now, coming up this week, we have the ISM factory orders coming up on Monday. And a whole bunch of news that probably will be important from Clorox and Noble Energy. We have Visa coming out. Tuesday also, factory orders. And we're going to see things from, Groupon, Tesla, Herbalife. Let's see what I was going to see here. That's interesting. Let me just go down my list. ADP jobs report on Wednesday. ISM services index on Wednesday. Allergan's going to be reporting. Etsy, which will be interesting to watch. Facebook. After the close on Wednesday, MetLife, Michael Kors, see if there anything has turned around with Kors, Qualcomm, Time Warner, and Whole Foods. Whole Foods has been in a free fall for months now. A lot of scandals, a lot of issues, pricing issues, competition. We'll see how that plays out. Kind of interesting to watch Whole Foods on Wednesday. Now, Thursday, we'll see the initial claims that recently were at the 1970s lows, going back many, many years to low areas. And a big question with the Fed, and there's a little confusion as to why we're seeing such a robust amount of the numbers dropping. So I guess, incredibly when it comes to initial claims versus the recent jobs numbers that we saw that were weakening. So on Thursday, we're also going to see DreamWorks Animation come out, Kraft & Heinz, Molson Coors, Monster Beverage, Shake Shack. We're going to be watching that one closely, as well as Disney. And then we're going to have, of course, the all-important jobs numbers on Friday. We're going to see whether or not the last couple of months were a bit of an aberration, or if, in fact, there's going to be a major move towards getting back to the over 200,000 plus level that everybody had hoped for. Now, we have to also put this into the discussion of what the heck is the Fed going to do? One of the big problems that we've seen is the deflationary environment as the euro has been dropping, or at least it had been dropping and recently dropped last week as well. With Japan really punching up the quantitative easing program and sustaining it for some time. With all of the things that's going on around the world in terms of currency wars and the dollar rallying, which has been a major problem for emerging markets, those markets that are dependent on all sorts of natural resources, as well as commodity pricing. Now, as we see that the United States government has been... The Fed has been going back and forth as to what they're going to do, which they recently hinted this week in their rate announcement that the potential for a December rate hike is very real. In fact, some of the wording that they used in this particular rate announcement, and they didn't have a conference call or a news conference afterwards, this particular rate discussion and the release of the information had some of the strongest language that we've seen in a long time from the Fed in terms of their desire to potentially, with, of course, the caveat, if economic conditions provide that this would be something that would be wise and warranted, that they potentially could raise interest rates at least that 0.25%, which is nothing, by the way. I mean, it's not like it's major rate increase, but again, a number... That would satisfy those that think that at this point in the economic cycle, it's ridiculous to have a zero bound. Raise interest rates by the end of the year. And they talked about how many of the regions around the country in all the Fed reports had been coming in much stronger than they thought. The jobs numbers were decent. Inflation is getting close. That being the case, the dollar will continue to rally, causing commodity prices to continue being under pressure. I think iron ore hit a 50-year low recently. But we're seeing this across the board. And at the same time, the brainiacs over in Europe are wondering, how do we get to move towards killing this whole deflationary spiral that we're seeing? And you know what we're going to do? We're going to create more money and drop the euro even lower. Because, of course, we know that dropping the euro is good for this, right? Well, no, it's not. Dropping the euro, one of the major currencies traded against the dollar, and moving the dollar higher actually drops the prices of commodities. So if they're trying to fight this deflationary spiral, it seems they're using the wrong tool to me. Yeah, they're pushing money into the banks. They're pushing money into the economy. They're liquefying the markets in general. They're creating a better import-export equation because it's much cheaper to buy things in Europe when the euro is lower, of course. They're increasing the potential for travel and tourism. I get all that. But they are talking the game of a deflationary spiral. And the problem is the very nature of quantitative easing with anywhere else outside the U.S., causes deflation. This has been something that has really been bugging me. Everybody's talking about, oh, quantitative easing isn't working. It's causing deflation. The truth of the matter is, if the United States was the only country in the world to be doing quantitative easing or dropping their currency through devaluation, if we were the only country around the world doing this, we would see inflation significantly kick into gear. The problem is everybody else thought it was a really good idea to do so. They said, oh, you know what? Look at how great that revived the economy and how it really liquefied all the economy and it pushed stocks up. And look at what's going on in the United States. We're going to do the same. The second they started doing it, and the second we saw them do it in a level that was comparable to the U.S., is when we started to notice that the dollar strengthening is causing problems for the commodities around the world. And because many of these countries came in after the fact, after we started doing this, the problem is that they caused more trouble by the basic fact that they did it. So it's backfiring on them and they don't want to admit it. Or, on the other hand, look at it as they're using the whole deflation issue as an excuse to continue it. Either way, by this continuing, it's going to hurt the global economy overall. It has to. Something has got to give. We can't keep having these currency wars and expecting that we're going to see that there's going to be a benefit for every single country around the world. Essentially, we need to stop this. This whole myth of quantitative easing everywhere around the world helping everything is not true. And I'm not saying this because here we're in America and, you know, oh, we're better at this. I'm not even saying any of that. But the fact is, as commodities are priced in dollars, you can't have an inflationary environment in much of the commodity space, like oil, for example, around the world, if you're actually dropping the value of your currency against the dollar. It just doesn't work that way. And you're going to hurt yourself. So anyway, that whole quantitative easing thing I think is pretty amazing. But the big flip-flop that we did see this week was clearly the Fed. Clearly the Fed was much more hawkish, at least in their commentary or their rate decision, than anyone would have expected. What was really interesting about that was initially, once that report came out, markets dropped and took out any gains that were there, that were ahead of it, that were looking basically in anticipation of their of the words being very dovish. Markets dropped off probably about 100 points from the top and then sat there for a few minutes, thought about it, and then all of a sudden rose, and by the end of the day, we're right back up to the highs that we saw before the announcement came out. For whatever reason, could have been end-of-month window dressing, try to boost up returns. Or they were seeing something in those commentary that was different, which I can't figure out, that was maybe more dovish. Or they pretty much don't trust the Fed because the credibility is shot at this point. And even though they flip-flopped a little bit on this whole idea that there was going to be the potential for a rate hike at the end of this year, or potentially, that they really didn't mean it. That, you know, they say that, but push comes to shove, nothing's going to happen. So here we are. Right back to where we started, not knowing anything. The Fed pretty much confusing everybody by their transparency, by their desire to actually open up the whole idea of letting everybody know pretty much out there what the Fed's going to do, stopping any surprise from happening. All they're doing is creating more confusion overall. In other government news, we saw that the budget deal passes a major hurdle to fund the government, so there's no shutdown, or at least hopefully no shutdown. But looks like there's some pretty substantial spending increases and some increase in taxes too. So according to reports, the measure gives Obama almost 90% of the additional money for domestic programs that he asked for back in February. And it also lifts the spending limits that the administration contended were hindering the economy. I don't know. You know, if I hear the word infrastructure development or expansion again as the key to everything, I'm probably going to puke. But there was that. Then also, there was this whole issue with the shortfall in the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. I don't know if you've been following any of this, but there was an expectation for this to run out, you know, somewhere in 2016 or 17, I believe it was. It's pretty close to now. And there was this back and forth about what to do about that. So the Democrats had thought that maybe a simple transfer of the payroll tax revenue from the Social Security Retirement Fund to the disability account would work. I don't know. I mean, robbing Peter to pay Paul, and Paul is bankrupt, and Peter's bankrupt too. So I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work, but there was some changes to the program, and they allowed some of this, but agreed also to increasing the contribution from 1.8% to 2.3% of wages on taxes, Social Security taxes. So the bottom line here is that at least at this point, we have at least a major hurdle that is being passed. But here's something also that I found in this I thought was kind of interesting, and that was that part of this budget deal is paid for in part by the U.S. selling 58 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So that's kind of interesting. We're going to have a flood of oil on the market now. And it also changes the way partnerships such as hedge funds and private equity firms are audited to increase tax compliance. And that's going to raise like $11 billion. So this particular last minute put together of a bill that will allow for the government to stay open is going to cost everybody something. And it's going to provide some kind of a stopgap to the evaporation and exhaustion of the Social Security disability insurance program. So that's kind of interesting, I thought, overall, because, once again, we're getting nothing done, really. We're just moving pieces around on this puzzle. And this particular administration, inclusive of Congress, et cetera, is just, I don't know, it's just, they just can't seem to get anything done. But, I think that is a great a point that we can leave into segueing into what happened this week. If you didn't watch this entertaining Republican debate, hopefully you could maybe catch it on a rerun, because this is one of those things, usually a debate, why would you want to watch it again? This was entertaining as can be. So CNBC ran hosted the Republican debate. They have the various CNBC anchors and journalists and various news folk over from CNBC. Carl Quintanilla, Becky Quick, John Harwood. And I got to tell you something, from the opening question to the end, I thought it was an embarrassment, frankly, the way the moderators were, frankly, quite unprofessional. It looks like they were just jabbing and looking for the entertainment value, saying really mean and nasty commentary to what may be one of the, and all of the candidates, but one of the final presidents of the United States. Now, whether that or not that happens, the fact is that it was just disrespectful, disgraceful. And I thought that it really was a real low note in the entire political campaign process. I'm not alone, by the way. You can go anywhere and see pretty much that when you look at who was the biggest loser in the debate, and it was clearly CNBC. The only benefit CNBC got out of it was they are getting so much press for their bad actions and their just horrible process of this debate, their very unprofessional ways that they handle this, and their clear bias against the Republicans. At least it showed that way during the debate, that I guess we could say that any particular, I guess they say, you get to press. What kind of press is bad? Well, no press is bad, right? Any press is good press. So even though it's negative press, it may be reflecting that they see some higher audience metrics moving on, because people want to find out what the heck is going on with this CNBC company and this station. But I was really embarrassed for them. I thought, why aren't they asking questions that have much more substantive appeal to their station and their watchers and their audience, like about the economy, like what they're going to do about maybe, things like budgets? What about the government's role in the Fed? They touched upon that briefly, but they really didn't have as the core of their discussion the economy, nor did they talk really about what was each candidate's particular platform, rather than put them on the defensive in almost every single question. The overall preparation was poor, And I think the direction of the questions and the way they phrased their questions was very mean-spirited, and it was very much to be inflammatory. Now, again, I think it was very entertaining from the aspect of we look at it as entertaining. Informational, it was not. Beneficial as a debate to find out maybe more about each of the candidates to see, as a voter, who would I like or not like to vote for? I think there was zero provided. Now, the RNC, Republican National Grouping, who books the various debates, has said that they're not doing any more NBC debates. The one in February is canceled. The shenanigans that was pulled by CNBC, lack of professionalism, and what they did here does not allow for any more of these to go on, because we're just not going to do anything with CNBC. Now, the candidates had different opinions. For the most part, many of them were pretty disgusted. I think it was Donald Trump and who else was it? Donald Trump, Chris Christie, and Ben Carson. I think those three were okay with the debate. They didn't really say anything negative about the debate and the format, questions, etc. But everybody else was pretty much up in arms. Really, really aggravated. So I thought it was just something to bring up, because not about the necessarily about the campaigns of any of them or the election itself, but just how CNBC operates. Because one of the things we all do, I mean, you have a couple of different choices, right? You could look at Bloomberg TV, maybe Fox Business, and if you're watching television, and Bloomberg, Fox, and CNBC. They're pretty much three major daytime informational sources for news related to markets and business, right? Pretty much. I'm talking about network television now. I'm not talking about internet or apps or online. I'm talking about network television. But it shows you how sensational they are in terms of when they try to get news items. It shows you how they lack depth and they don't ask the hard questions. That's why on many of the shows, when you watch it and they have CEOs on, they're just kind of throwing them softballs. They're asking them, you know, they're kidding around. They want to be friends. They want to hear themselves talk more than they want to hear the answers. And that's exactly what showed through in the debate. If you've ever listened to questions being posed by the people on CNBC, for the most part, the questions are far longer than the answers. And the interruptions are enormous. The kidding around and the, you know, especially during the morning shows. I watch it because I want to see what's happening in terms of news. Do my best to shut out most of the noise that's going on. But I'm sharing this with you for a point. Because generally speaking, a lot of people take what happens on TV as gospel. But realize that there are biases when it comes to the way they are reporting. The information may not be presented, and a lot of people may be on there just to sell their book or really promote their own level of interest. Just keep that in mind when you're listening to various stations on the networks, when you're reading the news. It's important to go beyond the headlines. We've talked about this 1,000 times. But it's also important to understand where the source is, where the bias may be, and if the news itself is the pure news, or if it's, you know, really not being vetted very well, and we're just seeing something that's being pushed by the source itself. All right, let's move on. I want to mention something about the couple things, sector rotation. So in the month of October, maybe even partially starting back to September, there was an enormous rotation that we've talked about several times. You know, the move from those stocks that were leading the market and those sectors that were leading the market, for example, biotech, healthcare, into those that were underperforming significantly, for example, oil and materials. That was exaggerated again towards the mid part and end of October, as there was a few things that went on. First of all, as we get into the final quarter of the year, oftentimes what you do see is those hedge funds, institutions, and investors looking to be balanced in their portfolio, doing a simple rotation for those stocks that have done really well, sell them off, and for those stocks that have not, or sectors that have not, buy in. So you saw that the money was rotating from those, the extra performance, taking that out, clipping some of the gains, and putting in the underperforming sectors in order to long-term, hopefully, get the benefit of buy at the lows and sell at the highs. That's first of all. Then you had the dollar coming down in value ever so slightly throughout the month or so. Well, that aided commodity pricing. And of course, as commodity companies have been stung pretty significantly by the drop in commodity prices, well, you did see that there was a real compressed move into many of these companies. And because there is such a significant amount of shorts that are outstanding on these companies, well, obviously that short squeeze was exaggerated. Now, what are we seeing now? Well, you're still moving into a situation at the end of the year that we now have the potential for a renewal of the dollar strength due to the fact of what the Fed said last week and the ECB. So now you have the potential for many of those commodity prices to start slumping again. And as such, the potential is that those short squeezes that went on may be reversed, at least partially, throughout the quarter, as we did see that the momentum move into many of the commodities and materials companies or related to really picked up steam. Now, whether or not that goes into, let's say, biotechs that have been obliterated after the Hillary Clinton tweet and because of all the issues going on with Valeant. And if you haven't been following the whole Valeant symbol VRX over the last few weeks, this is really getting pretty exciting. You got all sorts of potential problems with the specialty pharma like the Philidor and a few others they're using. You have all sorts of news blips coming out from all sorts of sources, ex-employees, short sellers, analysts that are really negative on some of the things they're doing. We saw that big report by Citron last week that called this company the next potential Enron in the healthcare area, which obviously has some real serious implications of fraud, off-book financing, as well as phantom companies that the company is using to boost up their profits. And some of that information really got detailed last week with this whole Philidor relationship that they have. We did see Walgreens and CVS drop Philidor as a specialty pharma. We saw that analysts are cutting their ratings and coverage, and Standard & Poor's is actually cutting their rating on the company stock. We saw a few major hedge fund fellas come out with all sorts of slideshows and, you know, backing of this company. As a matter of fact, I think that Bill Ackman spent about 4 or 5 hours on the phone rambling at times, it seemed, from some of the excerpts about, you know, why this is a good company. We saw the entire board come out of the company and reiterate all the goodness that the company does. But in the end, even with Bill Ackman's additional purchase of 2 million shares, I mean, this guy's down like $6 billion, I think it is, potentially, if he doesn't have any options offsetting. Maybe about $6 billion from the high where we saw this company this year. Stock traded on Friday at a low of, after the close, I think at about $92.50 or $93, down from like $270 mid part of this year. And that's the low we've seen recently. I think, $88. We saw the company drop initially on the Citron news down to about 88, got halted, came right back up to about 95, then 100 and change. Spiked up to about 127 this week when some, you know, news was hitting out and coming out and some of the shorts got squeezed higher. And then as we saw further information come out throughout the week, as well as the information from ex-employees on some of their practices of shopping around and changing doctor's orders so to make sure that the company gets paid the highest amount for prescriptions or something of that nature, where they were doing something internally that really wasn't supposed to be done in terms of how these specialty pharmas operate. And it was in the manual, supposedly, the employee manual that gave instructions on how to do some of this stuff. That, again, bad news, not really good procedures, makes the company look really questionable in terms of their ethics and overall, you know, their financial, I guess it would be, you know, the way the company is in terms of their handling of things, whether it's sketchy or not. So I'd keep a watch on this Valiant. I don't know what's going to play out of this. It would seem from the news flow that we've seen that all of this progression of the bad news is building. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some other announcements this week in terms of information maybe from either other short sellers or other analysts or employees that are spilling some of the dirt on this company. And it could be all orchestrated by companies and investors who are looking to profit on the downside of this, or there could be some truth in this that's really just coming out slowly. And when it, you know, when that shell breaks, it breaks fast. You know, Enron went on for years, but all of a sudden when that whole, there was some cracks in the armor, things got crazy very quickly. Moving along back to markets, and we'll wrap it up here, but I want to mention something, a couple things that are kind of important, I think. We talked about the sector rotation. We did see that an interesting thing is happening in terms of a rotation also towards size. When you compare the equal-weighted S&P versus the S&P itself, now the S&P 500 index is a capitalization-weighted index where the largest companies have the largest effect on performance. They're weighted heavier in terms of the percent that is calculated in terms of looking at the performance of this index. There's also an equal-weighted index that you could find. The equal-weighted index takes each and every stock inside the S&P 500 and just looks at the return, averages it, and that's what the return is. Now, since the bottom in September or right in the beginning of October, the equal-weighted index has underperformed by about 4.5%, we'll call it 4%, versus the S&P index, meaning that the top stocks, the largest stocks, are the ones that are really carrying the weight. And you can see this. If you look at stocks, just generally speaking, and you look at what's gone on, how much they've dropped, how much they've come back, really what has been the big player right now is the big names, right? We're seeing the Microsofts, the Google, the Amazons, the Apple. Oh, Apple's down a bit, but we're seeing the big names are the ones that have been really holding up very well and helping the performance of the S&P 500, where many of the smaller names have been dropping. And because some of these smaller names, smaller market capitalization, don't hold as much of a weight in the S&P 500 itself, what we've seen is those are dropping even more. For example, just look at the differential between the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000 small cap index. There's a big difference there. So there is this divergence that is occurring, and it is a flight to safety. Also, we're seeing that the breadth of the market, the stocks that are up versus down, really came back and evened out a bit in October from where it was in September, where it was a thinning breath, where only a few stocks were really pulling it. But by the end of October, once again, we're seeing that breath in terms of the relationship of a few stocks pulling up the performance of the markets versus the many is once again getting a little bit leaner. When that happens, that means that there is the potential that if anything happens, and we do see that there is a break because of either an economic circumstance, maybe an earnings issue, markets are vulnerable. We're seeing a lot of overbought signals right now in terms of the market. Some of the greatest we've seen in about 3 years, according to my algorithms. Now, I'm not sure this means necessarily that stocks are going to crash or anything like that, but it would seem to me that this recent rise that we saw in October was a little bit exaggerated for really what was going on. Earnings overall have dropped. Yes, they've come back. We've seen about 70% of companies beating estimates, but you know what? Revenues are crap. The growth, we're looking for growth. You have to have growth in order to see momentum of markets move, because if you don't have growth, the point is you shouldn't see prices go higher because ratios like the PE ratio, et cetera, move out of whack. And that's what we're seeing again. I think the PE ratio on the S&P is back to the high where it was before we saw this correction. And we're seeing the outlook come down again for earnings next quarter. And to really put a cherry on top of all this, one of the interesting things that we're finding is that this market's pretty hard in terms of comparatively looking at it from an index standpoint to an investor standpoint. And what I mean by that is it's interesting that indices are holding up okay right now. Again, October was a major month that brought things back up to where they were, but hedge funds are having the worst year overall they've had since 2008. That's pretty interesting, don't you think? Hedge funds having the worst year since they had in 2008. But yet markets are somehow levitating on slower economic growth, slower global growth, slowing earnings, revenue. Now, the reason? Well, we could draw a lot of possible reasons. Could be that ETFs and index funds are really leading in terms of the investment program that most people want to use. Could be that other governments, like the Japanese government, who said that many months ago their pension plans are able now to invest lots more money, and I'm talking about billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, into stocks domestically and elsewhere. As the yen goes down in value and the dollar comes up in value, there's a big correlation to what happens with the markets here in the United States. I wonder if the Japanese government is really plowing a lot of money into various index funds on the S&P 500, and that's what's really pushing things higher. Something to think about. Sovereign wealth funds, the same thing. They have very long time horizons, and maybe what they're doing is they're simply going out and purchasing U.S.-based stocks, hoping that they're not only going to get the benefit of maybe some price appreciation from the stocks, but also the fact that their currency, they're committed to dropping their currency value down, and they at least think that the Fed's going to raise rates, and that should push the dollar higher. They get a double benefit. And if stocks don't go up in value, the fact is that if the dollar still continues higher in value, they at least get that as a partial gain on their portfolio. Something to think about. Anyway, we're going to end it here on this beautiful Sunday, November 1st, 2015. Changing the clocks. Hopefully everybody's getting enough sleep. I know I was up pretty early in the morning, and I looked at my clock. Oh, look what time it is. I slept in a little bit, then realized, no, I really didn't. So anyway, I wish you well. I hope that if you have any questions, you can send them to me, of course, at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, which is the handle. And of course, visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com for all the show notes and information on this and DH Unplugged. Have a great week. Have a great November. Here we go.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.